Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Michael Jones. I'm joined by my co-host, John Rossi.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Man, I'm doing wonderful. It's been a fabulous weekend. We've had great weather here. I hear up there it kind of got cold a little bit, but the following week's supposed to be pretty good from what I understand.
Yeah, it was, kind of your traditional fall day today. It was like in the 60s, and it's going to get down until about 30 tonight. So, winter's on the way.
And we've got our good friend, Robert E. Graves, here. And welcome, Robert. Robert?
Well, did you say something to Robert to make him hang up?
I don't know.
Robert is here. However, I think that what happened,
I know what's happening, Robert. You've got the Blog Talk website up, and if you'll look on the previous page from the chat, there's a media player going, and you have to hit stop.
Yeah, let me. Nope.
There you go.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, if you'll minimize your chat screen that goes to Blog Talk Radio and just shut off that other web page, you'll be safe.
Okay.
There you go. Okay, so how's your week been going, Robert?
I've been doing well. I'm basically just working on all kinds of different things that I have happening here. I've got this project, the Art of Psychic Dice project. I've got taking notes and working on the next novel.
Oh, wonderful, man. Our audience may not be familiar with you. Could you explain? I mean, let's start out with this. The whole idea behind psychokinesis. I mean, is there a good general description that most people could understand?
I think for the most part, psychokinesis is a connection, is a spiritual connection between individuals and the material. It's between their spiritual reality and the material world. And that includes anything like we're talking about here, from dice, shooting dice, to faith healing.
Okay, cool. The other thing I was going to ask you about, I was reading some of your book, and I found some fascinating ideas in there. One of the things that I did notice you bluntly put in there multiple times is if you don't have the money to spend and lose, don't gamble. Kind of thought, and I think that's probably a very wise statement. But that's just a general thing to warn people that what they're dealing with. But I think the most thing that caught my eye was when you were discussing people at a craps table and getting these dice runs that were just so amazing it went beyond the chance of physics. And could you explain a little bit of that for the audience?
Well, to begin with, you're absolutely right. Never bet money you can't afford to lose. It's the thing that is most in the back of people's heads, I think, when they start thinking about applying their spirituality, if you will, to being at in the world's maybe the most material endeavor in the world. I've experienced all kinds of magical, metaphysical, and psychokinetic energies going on. But at a craps table, it's basically at one point I watched a die bounce on top of a chip and begin spinning like a top. When the event started, the table was maybe one, possibly two deep. We all just stood there looking at it. I mean, it was just this amazing thing. The person's point was six, which means they had to roll a six before they rolled a seven. And one dice bounced off the other table and came up five. The other one bounced on the chip, as I said, and began spinning. There was a few people at the table, and I looked up around the table. It was three deep. People were running our direction. I looked back, and three three blackjack tables that quit dealing. Everybody there was looking our direction, and it was at that point I looked back at the die, realized that this amazing event was happening. I don't know anybody else in the world. I haven't met anybody else, even heard of anybody else, who has ever seen a die bounce on a chip and begin spinning, but then just not stop spinning. And I realized that it was just an amazing moment. It was beyond all the laws of physics. Actually, the part of the story I don't include in the book is I actually bumped into the guy who had thrown the dice. I accidentally hit his butt with my hand, and at that time the die began wobbling. And a woman at the other end of the table hit the table, set six. The die came off. It was ace up, and the five and the one had made the six. That grabbed my attention.
Wow, wow. Well,
so
go ahead, John.
Robert. You know, I read your book a couple of months ago before you came on our show the first time, and, you know, I learned a lot about PK that I didn't know, but I also learned a lot about playing craps because I knew absolutely nothing at all about that. Why did you end up using, you know, basically the casino as the place that you were going to show how PK can affect us in the real world and in our everyday lives?
It wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't like I'm a businessman who decided to go out and figure out how to infuse the ideas I had about spirituality with the world and say, well, how can I do that and get people's attention? It just happened that way. There were older people around me who were into the magical, metaphysical, paranormal, and to the extent that they could be and to the extent they could admit to it. And people didn't talk about it much back then, at least overtly. It was always a subtext, and you could talk about it as a subtext, but you couldn't go direct with it. And an older friend that took me and one of his friends took me to a craps table and began showing it to me. And so it was kind of the other way around. It was them taking me there and then having this amazing event with the die. It grabbed me and caught my attention. What it did then was spirit me off, if you will, into into this looking at how the magical metaphysical work. Because up until then, I've been reading about it and thinking about it and reading these different people that said it existed. Zen masters said it exists. A guy named Lobsang Rapa, who was an Indian mystic that had supposedly taken over a European's body and wrote all these books, and it was all there, but nothing was going on. I mean, there were some other experiences before then, but not really. And so it was that's where I realized I could go up there and watch the magical, metaphysical, spiritual realm at any time I wanted to. At least I thought it was happening around there all the time, and so that's how I went into it. It kind of grabbed me, not the other way around.
Hey, Robert, this is a quick question. Dale in the chat room was wondering, how long would you estimate that dice was spinning on that chip?
Can't say. I really can't say. The only time I have with it is that knowing that when the event started, the table was one, maybe two deep, and nobody said anything. We all just stood there looking at it, but at one point, I finally looked up. The table had become three deep, if not four in some places. I remember looking up to the other end of the table where the dice was happening. But beyond that, a guy was running. I have no idea how he knew anything was going on. But he was running up to the table to try to get on his tiptoes and look over everybody else. And as I said, I also had time to look back, and three blackjack tables had just quit dealing. And they were all turned – I mean, their chairs were all turned around our direction and staring at us. So, you know, in trying to weigh and measure it, I can't say, but it was beyond all the laws of physics.
Wow.
So given that, you know, dealers at the casinos probably see a lot of odd things and pretty much on a daily basis, the fact that they were taking notice really does suggest that this was something out of the ordinary.
Well, it wasn't just dealers at the craps table. It was, as I said, I looked back behind me to blackjack tables, and
right.
It wasn't as if those dealers had a choice. Everybody at the blackjack tables, you're talking about five, six people, maybe 15, 18 people, were all turned our direction and the dealers. So somehow this thing that only the people who were actually at the craps table could physically see, it had gotten their attention somehow also.
Wow. So, I mean, you were there. What level of excitement? I mean, was it just literally dumping off of people and you could feel it?
You know, at the time, I was new to the magical metaphysical happening kind of that directly. And so, as I said, it was an amazing moment, and it wasn't a question of me feeling it. That you know, back then, people dressed in slacks and wore ties. They might wear suits, and I had, you know, maybe $6 in my pocket, and I had cutoffs and a clean shirt, but I wasn't pressed. And it was more like it was a foreign land in some ways, and so I was just taken in by the newness of it all, rather than anything that I could that I could get into later and try to figure out what that was exactly, right. You know, how it all worked. It was only afterwards that I spent a lot of time at tables and began piecing it all together, what must have happened and how it happened.
Cool. I know there's places in your book you were talking about the general getting people amped up and changing the ratio of, you know, that random chance happening. Was that a direct observation? Like, as in, you're sitting there at the table, and somebody throws dice, and every time everybody was excited, they seemed to be more successful than others, or was it something else?
I'm not certain what your question is. Can you ask again, please?
Well, for instance, what I'm saying, you're observing people's reactions and how they were acting around the table when, you know, people were gambling, right?
Uh-huh.
And what I'm getting at is, you know, when you started catching on to what was happening, what were you noticing?
Well, Robert, I think he's asking you about that whole, like, enlisting people, you know, and having the group consciousness and how that impacts on the outcomes.
Well, you know, that kind of came later. Again, we're talking about the early 1970s, and back then, if you talked overtly about telepathy or the magical metaphysical, you could be hauled off in a straitjacket. I'm not exaggerating that a whole lot. And so it was all subtext, but one of the important things is that everybody, as far as I can tell, and they still do, we're trying to use it. You know, at one level, gamblers all know that the game within the game is metaphysical. And on the other side of it, what I've learned is the paranormalists all realize that the metaphysical is a bit of a crapshoot, you know, because it can't be all replicated. And so you're dealing with that. You're dealing with the social constraints of being overt about it. But everybody there is trying to use it in one way or another. The big thing is, among the most interesting was that really people were trying to overpower each other. That was the dominant thing that I saw, and I eventually realized you had to overcome to get it to work. You know, if you wanted, if you feel that two heads are better than one, and three are better than two, and ten are better than three, if you want to begin moving those together and getting them to function as one, you've got to overcome. You've got to get around people trying to control it. And it's one of the impediments at a craps table because it's difficult to do. You've got to find ways to connect with them and communicate. And then even now, underneath it all, they've got to kind of agree that, hey, this is all happening, and we're going to go with this. You know, it's one of the reasons I would like to put a group together eventually, you know, kind of like the one modeled on that we've talked about before, the people in Toronto that the real Conjuring of Philip, you know, get people to practice for a couple of years that have a, you know, similar interest, and then
Robert,
go to a craft table. Sure.
Could you go ahead and just briefly explain what you're talking about there? Because there's probably some people here tonight that weren't here on the first conversation and may not know, this backstory.
Well, I think the first thing that you really have to understand is probably what I'm not talking about. And to begin with that, it all starts with the notion that somehow, that's not quite the way to say it, is that there's a connection between our brain waves and the spiritual realm. No one's got that nailed down yet. They don't understand exactly what that is, what the spiritual realm is exactly, but there's a connection. Somehow our brains do connect with that. And the first thing that people you can do to develop that is just to concentrate. Some people can go to their basement and they can try to move a pencil or a paper clip, and some of them do it. Or they can take a compass and make it move differently. And some people have that ability also. They just do it. It's part of the way their brain works. Others, have friends who have that ability. You know, possibly somebody's developed it or learned it somehow, how to get into their brain and do that. And you can become close to those people, and you can gain this power, you can gain access to how that happens. And it's called entrainment. You're training your own brain to do that, and it comes by being close to somebody that has that. There's also a group out there, James V. Hart, H-E-R-D-T, is the president of the BioCybernauts. Yep, let me just read that correctly, BioCybernaut Institute. And he does it with biofeedback, and he goes into all the spiritual realms. So the basic idea is that all the spiritual realms of my book is that all the spiritual realms have that connection, and there are various different ways to get to it. My book's not about that. It's not about that kind of personal development. The book is more specifically about how to use agreement, emotions, and suggestion, both within yourself and among others, to maximize the psychic energies that you're dealing with. And I would say that, you know, everybody's heard of the Law of Attraction and the book The Secret. One of the questions I would ask, and the book tries to answer, although it doesn't address it that directly, is, well, once you've got attraction, what do you do? And so that's where the book is basically going, is after you've got that and you've got those energies going, how do you maximize them? And so that's why I say that anybody who's got any level of a paranormal ability or psychic ability and likes to work with it, or if you're just going to your neighborhood faith healing session, the book is for you, because if you can extract the principles, you can understand how to hype what you've got and make it more intense.
Well, back to the Canadian Paranormal Research Group and the entity that they produced. I think a lot of people here don't understand what, you know, you were referring to earlier.
Okay, yeah, that was what they were trying to do was the Toronto Psychical Society, and their book was called Conjuring Up Philip. What they were attempting to do was prove whether or not ghosts existed. And so their method of doing it was an attempt to give a backstory to a ghost. It was very Carmen-esque. Carmen is an opera. It was a very Carmen-esque kind of story where you got a guy named Philip. He falls in love with actually he's married to a shrew, and he falls in love with another woman, the gypsy woman, and then the wife kills the gypsy woman. And so that's where the Paranormal Society starts their story, and the Toronto Psychical Society starts the story. And so they try to conjure Philip, and they kind of hold these seance kinds of things, and it takes them a few months to get into it, but eventually they begin getting responses from Philip. And what they decided was that because Philip was a completely made-up story, that they weren't actually connecting with a ghost. And John gave a different answer the other day from one I had heard. He thinks that what they conjured was kind of a doppelganger. What they decided is that it was probably something from inside themselves, and they were able to get all kinds of rappings. You know, that's me hitting the table. That's not a real rap. They got all kinds of wrappings, and they got, but they also got all kinds of psychokinetic energy, which I would really like to view, because apparently they did it on Canadian television, and they've done it, and they demonstrated in front of a lot of other people before their group broke up.
Yeah, you know, that's you know, fascinating. I mean, so are you hoping to, like, replicate something like that? Because you were mentioning that you'd like to do a study at some point.
Well, I wouldn't like to do a study. I would like to attract enough people, because it took them a year or two to do it. But it displayed all of the, you know, if you kind of read between the lines and figure out what they're doing, it used some of the same methods that that I'm trying to do. So the things that I want to that I detail in the book in Art of Psychic Dice. And it has to do with basically, again, as I said, with using your emotions to get suggestion, agreement, emotions, and suggestion. The center of it being that what you really want to do with people is have an idea underneath everything, or is the intention that you're going for, and you try to bring your minds together so that you're all in agreement at the same time. And I think one of the most fascinating things that I've learned at the craps table is that the agreement doesn't necessarily have to be – I mean, you're already agreeing about what it is your intention is. You can create agreements around all kinds of other things. And as I suggest in the book, you can maybe bring political things in. Those might not be the best ideas, but you can find other things to agree to. And one of the most fascinating, best ways to agree is with humor. If somebody can use a joke that just cuts through the whole thing, that basically solves the problem. And people ultimately, when they're laughing, are agreeing. And they're also, as they're agreeing, they're sort of subconsciously, unconsciously emanating their agreement with everybody else in a way that's incredibly positive. You can get 10 people to agree simultaneously, to laugh simultaneously. What you're trying to accomplish is going to be 9/10 of the way there, maybe 99% of the way there most of the time.
Wow. Hey, we talked off air a while ago, and we were talking about historical aspects of how man has tried to understand reality and how all this functions. There were some examples you were giving. I mean, you mind talking about that?
You know, can you remind me which ones I was mentioning at that point?
We were talking about, early on in mankind, they're using the moon and other, planetary objects and stars to try to make sense of the universe, and then they kept moving on and on and on and kept developing, and then religions came about, and they were trying to do their best to understand, what's going on and understand the universe. Was there anything historically you came across that it was pretty much in line with what you're talking about?
I'd never tried to put all that together. When my mind goes back to history and I think about you guys, because you're really into the ghosts and the EVPs and all of that, I would send a question back to you that goes a little bit off subject, but I've got to wonder. I did go to the Watergate hearings. That was back in back in the 70s when they were going after Nixon. And one of the things, and I went for about a month every day. I would go in there, and then afterwards I would hang around D.C. But one of the things that was read into the congressional record, eventually made the congressional record, but was read into their notes, was the description of somebody seeing Lincoln's ghost in the White House. Now, I know you guys know that's sort of old hat to you, and that happens all the time, but that is one of the areas where there's an official record of it happening. But beyond that, my question would be, and I don't expect to be able to answer it right now, is how come nobody's gone in and exercised that ghost? How come Lincoln is still wandering the White House? And what is it about that? again, it's off subject, but that's that idea fascinates me. I think it's – go ahead.
I was going to say, we'll have to ponder on that for a while and maybe look at the tea leaves and figure that one out. But just in terms of, you obviously have done a lot of research, and I think what Mike was asking is, do you have is there historical anecdotes or historical writings that suggest other people over time have, seen and experienced the, PK phenomena?
Well, I think that if you deal with just the caves at Lascaux, for instance, those are those paintings of the bison within the caves. And most people who look at that realize that the people were throwing do you know which caves I'm talking about in England, or excuse me, in Europe? They're in France, and they're 40,000 years old approximately. And there are even other ones around the world that they're even older than that, go back to 70,000 years. But in there, they've got these bison, and they're pretty certain the cavemen were throwing their spears at it. They would go in there, and they would have these ceremonies where these guys were throwing spears at it. And what they had, the way that segues into what I'm doing is these people were looking for agreement. They might not have been conscious that that's what they were doing, and that's what I'm hoping my book will partly do. As I said, once you've got the attraction, what do you do with it? And the thing that you do with it is to go for emotional agreement, as deep emotional agreement as you can. And historically, at the caves at Lascaux, that's what they were doing. They were throwing their spears and hoping for a good hunt so that they could attract the bison or go out and get nature to mold nature in the way that they wanted it to. Probably some of it was superstitious. Probably some of it was very real. A lot of times, also in older excavations, they always find bones. They know that they don't know, they weren't there, but they're pretty certain that these cave guys were, they would have bones, they would make dice out of them, and they were rolling them, not necessarily for gambling, but they think to divine the will of God. And so we've got that, you know, historically going. And then when you deal with historically the, the Inquisition, you know, it's 150 years in Europe, and they killed 500,000 witches. And part of it was probably, well, we just don't like those people, you know. But you got to think that underneath it all, you had somebody who was either afraid that the devil was coming through in some way, or that they weren't just all political enemies, that there was something more evil going on. But those people had to be doing something, had to have had something happening at that point that that got them in trouble. You know, part of it is just scapegoating, but part of it is some of them were adept at what we call remote viewing and clairvoyance. Others were adept at moving things around, and that could get you killed back there. When it comes up to a closer to our time, in the last century, or the century before last now, we had a guy named Hume in the late part of the 19th century, who was recorded, there are accounts of him levitating out of his room and then going out a window, going a few feet over and coming back in a different window. There are all kinds of accounts of those kinds of things. And we got the Fox Sisters back in the 1900s also had this whole spiritual revival, and you know that there are all kinds of psychokinetic energies going around it. I think that, you know, when you deal with when you read or, excuse me, listen to Powell, who wrote the ESP Enigma, and she's a neuropsychiatrist, I believe, who tries to explain how psychic phenomena works in the context of modern science. You end up with her saying that, or I've heard her say, that there's more evidence of how the magical, metaphysical, spiritual works than there is for most drugs to get approved.
Okay. Robert, you know, when you're talking about this, like, group agreement concept, you know, how is that different than when, like, let's say a hypnotist works with the sports team and, you know, like, before a game they're doing, like, positive imaging exercises, you know, they're, like, being talked through the game, they're being talked through the win. Is that different? Is it just a different method to get to that place?
Well, I think that it's different and it's not different. It's the same in that if you've got 11 guys, 35 guys on a football team or a basketball team or a baseball team being talked through something, that at the moment that they're there, while they're listening to that, that's happening to them. That it's and they are all in a certain amount of agreement. But what the most important thing of the whole thing is usually most likely left out of it, because they can't quite cop to the fact that there is a magical, metaphysical, spiritual realm. What they're saying is that if we can program our subconsciousness, if we can program the unconscious of these people, we can get them to function at a peak level. And so that's what they're shooting at, as far as I can tell. I haven't been in one of those locker rooms, but I'm pretty certain that's what they're doing. Because, again, there's a prohibition against talking directly about these things. And what I'm talking about, the thing that distinguishes it, that cuts through it all, is that you're looking to create an emotion with the people that you're dealing with. You know, if your aunt is in the next room, and or somebody's aunt is in the next room, and she's got 100 zillion microbes in her lungs, and you want those all to go away, you just went, boom, they're gone. You want something going on between the people in the next room over, the next house over, or even among 10 people who are just on a conference call together, who are putting their heads together as close as they can get. You want something emotional to flow through them all that's in agreement. Then that's the huge deal. You know, I really enjoy listening to Greg Braden. You mentioned, John, that I should read his book, and I did. And I didn't have time, The Isaiah Effect. I didn't have time yet to detail it all, to you know, take all the information out of it and incorporate it into this the way I'd like to. There's a lot of really good information in there. But one of the things that he writes in the book and that he talked about before is that he was in Tibet, and he asked the monks there, he says, how does this work? I watch you cure cancer. We're right here. You guys go through all these machinations, and you cure the cancer, or you go through the machinations, and objects start moving around the room. You know, what in the world is going on? And the monk answers him, well, you don't see our prayer. These machinations aren't what the prayer is. The machinations are what we do to produce the emotions. And it's the effect, it's the fact of the emotion that is the prayer. And that's really the center of what Art of Psychic Dice is all about. It's how to get that emotion to happen. But it's also, I go beyond that because to some extent you begin using suggestion. To a large extent you begin using suggestion also to get people to do that with you, to want the same emotional effect simultaneously. And that's where the most power is really lying.
So what you're saying, in essence, is emotion's like a direct conduit into the subconscious.
We don't know. Well, I would say the subconscious, and to the extent that your subconscious connects with the magical metaphysical, or it's a direct conduit into the magical metaphysical, yes. And again, it's a brainwave, ultimately. The psychokinetic energy is a brainwave. I'm certain they can detail which part of the brain it comes from, but what they can't detail is what the other side of it is, what it's connecting with, or even what it is. You know, I think you're a therapist, aren't you, Mike?
No, it's John.
Excuse me.
At one time, I think, wasn't it, John?
Yep.
Yeah, well, they don't know. I guess the point, again, that Powell makes, and I really enjoyed reading, is that they don't know what consciousness is. So they don't really know what consciousness is. They don't know what spirit is in terms of being able to describe it to weigh and measure it in terms of physics. But there's a direct connection there, and that's where the ultimate power is. You know, you can use all the laws of attraction, and to some extent those are based on emotion, but once you've got that energy there with you, then how do you direct it and how do you amplify it? And that's emotion.
So, Robert, this concept of agreement, and, you know, in order to do things that theoretically shouldn't be possible, yet there's examples of essentially the impossible happening. You know, are you talking about that there's people have an ability to, like, tap into some, like, universal consciousness and benefit from that energy or that force?
You know, I'd never given that kind of question very much thought, but in the last, I have to admit, I listen to Coast to Coast all the time, and what I'm hearing from in the last 6 months from the scientists that are coming out of there, from Robert Lanza, who's the top man, one of the top men on cloning in the world, to other physicists that they have on, is that what they think is going on is that consciousness/spirituality exists. And apparently Aldous Huxley said this also, and I've got to go back and reread it in The Doors Perception, is that it's all there and our brains are somehow wired to accept it, to tune into it, if you will, and to be able to connect with that. And it seems to go the other direction also, though. Our brains can also work so that we have an effect on that, so that we move that, and again, via emotion. I think that's probably the best model out there.
Okay. Hey, listen, Robert, before we, end up, talking through the entire show, I want to give you the opportunity. The last time, there were a couple of points in your book that you were, like, kind of regretting that we didn't get to. You know, there were some things that you thought, you would like to talk about. So, thinking back or even just right now, is there a certain aspect of your book that you want to just make sure that everyone listening tonight, comes away with?
Well, again, I seem really repetitive, but it is a way to make it, is that I didn't hit the emotion hard enough last time, because that really is the center of it. And also, the book is about how to get that emotion to, how to elicit that. And you can do that a lot with suggestion. And one of the two biggest points I think I missed is that laughter is really one of the things that again makes it happen. I've kind of alluded to it, but at a craps table, for instance, if if I want a four, I did four is the point, and the bets I have out there mean that I want a four to go. You know, there's an old tombstone in Tombstone territory. And on the inscription on the tombstone is, here lies Lester Moore, four shots from a .44, no less, no more. you know. And at a craps table at just the right moment, that takes everybody by surprise. They know exactly what you're doing, and they're in agreement with you because they like the fact that you're suggesting exactly what they want also the four, but they're also laughing because they're surprised and they can't stop themselves from laughing, and they're emanating what they want to do. And so, again, if you're at a faith healing session, you can think about it beforehand. You can begin setting up how you're going to make these people laugh, even though the aunt, and it's a deadly serious thing, is in the next room over, and she's having a problem of some kind that you want to that you want to solve. Part of the way you can solve that is that laughter comes first. You have, you know, they think it's the other way around. They think that you begin winning and then you start having fun, but it's the other way around. You basically have fun first and then you start winning, and that includes you have fun first and you start curing people. As backwards as that might seem, that really is the way it works. It's one of the, I mean, it's not the only way, probably, but it's one of the ways that I'm absolutely certain that you can use. The second point that I missed last time around that I wanted to get to, I alluded to it a little bit before, is that what you're agreeing to at the moment that you're eliciting emotion doesn't have to do with what it is you want. So if you're at a craps table, it's hard to really get worked up after a while over a 4 or a 10 or an 11 or a 12, you know, whatever you want. And it's one of the deadliest things, according to the experts, the people who have done science on how psychokinesis works, is when the boredom sets in. And you will see a lot of people are bored around it. So what you want to do is create an excitement about a separate issue besides a number or beside maybe the trillion bugs in your aunt's lungs, whatever it is that you're trying to go after. But you can. You can shift the focus away from the doldrums that are going on into something that's a lot of fun. And that ideological sleight, this is a really line I like from the book, but that ideological sleight of hand, you know, shifting it away from what it is you're trying, what your intention is, into something that is a lot of fun is the art of psychokinesis, is the art of shooting craps. It's also ultimately the art of faith healing.
Well, I have a question. If you were going to give somebody advice just on normal everyday life, you know, like just, you know, I wake up in the morning and, you know, how would you carry this once you kind of understand what you're getting at, what kind of advice would you give the person as far as everyday life and just how you interact with reality?
that narrowed it down for you, didn't it?
I'm trying to leave it open enough to where he can explain.
Yeah, wide open, I'd say.
It's a good question, though, also. I think you can use it all. One of the things that, you know, if we go back to Jack Houck again, Jack Houck I haven't explained here yet, but he was a guy that he was an engineer, and so he was very involved in how the world works mechanically. But he began putting together spoon bending parties, and he's had 300 or 400 of them. I've been to 3 of them altogether. And he teaches what are called peak emotional events, PEEs. And, you know, they involve basically 3 steps. The first step is focus concentration. Second step is to shout the command. And the third step is to let the whole thing go. And so focus concentration is your basic creative visualization. I personally like a woman named Shakti Gawain, Shakti, which means power in Hindi. And she's writing under a pen name, but I've met her, and I like the energy that emanated from her, but it has to do with just your basic visualization. It's getting yourself deeply relaxed and beginning to use that. So I think you're getting up in the morning, if you've got those, and when you're going to bed probably, and it's pretty standard, but you know, the standard things work. When I want to begin manifesting an intention, I work with that. I do a lot with that. Meaning that you try to take as much time throughout the day, but especially in the morning and in the evenings, getting as close to visualization. You might not actually have a picture of it, but getting that suggestion into your subconscious. But even within that, you want to, I would say, mostly people leave out is always harken back to emotions. You want to associate it with the emotional events that work for you. Then throughout a day, as you're going along, you can't begin shouting your commands. You know, you can't say, well, I want to make $1 million, a million. Yeah, I mean, you probably could. You probably go off into some place and your cubicle and do that. But you, whatever it is, you can remind yourself more for about it again. And the letting it go part is just part of that. Just let that happen and do something else with it. But the other thing that you do throughout the day is try to connect with people who are going to help you or understand what you want and get an agreement among them that it's okay. I mean, for practically with you guys, for instance, if you're going to go out on your ghost hunting expeditions, one of the things you might do beforehand, you know, is besides setting yourself up for, imagining what a successful ghost hunting event might be. You're going to go to a certain place that's haunted. You might have certain expectations. You'd want to leave it as open as much as you could. But you might get three or four of you together, even on the phone, or if you're in the same motel room the night before. And it wouldn't be exactly seance-like, but you might devote some time to understanding your attention and trying to figure out how to get each other to laugh simultaneously about getting that to happen. You know, so that, and I'm totally serious about this. I think it would also work with your, the clairvoyance, the remote viewers. I think not necessarily while you're in a remote viewing session, but if you got 6 hours before or 3 hours before, you might want to get your heads together and put out as a group, as emotionally as you can get it, positive energy about making that happen when you do it. And I think you can begin applying those things to anything that you're trying to accomplish then.
Right. And, I've done remote viewing in the past, and I've actually experienced that. The times that I was so jovial and not thinking directly about the remote viewing was when I was at my best.
You mentioned that before, and I was elaborating on that. I think you might be even able to take it back a couple hours. And if you've got your people together, is trying to do a session, maybe again like the Toronto Psychical Society, where you all begin expressing your attention. You know, you have to work it out. Psychology is different among all people. You know, what makes them laugh is different. What makes them agree is different. But you put a session together, I don't know, 5 minutes, a half an hour, depending on the people, maybe a couple hours, depending on them, where it's about that. What you're trying to do is find agreement among yourself that actually works. It's not necessarily about what you think is going to happen when you get into the haunted house, but is about making that work, is about making that happen in a way that's positive. And I think that the more positive things, the more emotionally you can make that, or the funnier you can make it. You know, each of you might bring 10 jokes that no one else has heard and that you don't expect, but somehow, while you're laughing, everybody else is laughing, you mentally, another thing you can do underneath that is mentally underneath that, remind each other what you're trying to accomplish. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean,
listen,
go ahead,
Robert. There's a couple questions in the chat room, and I just want to knock it too far. One is, are you using PK to control the dice, or is it precognition that's occurring?
One of the things that happened is early on, I got Mike got me into the chat room, and then I somehow got tossed out of it because I would have really have loved to have looked at that. But there was an interesting experiment, and I can't find the documentation on it. This is really interesting. Dr. Ryan, everybody's heard of, the famous parapsychologist from Duke University in the 20s and 30s and up into the 40s, had a gambler come in and say, hey, Dr. Ryan, look at this. And he pulled out the dice and began showing him that he thought he could control the dice. And so they tested this guy, and so they had him think about the number he wanted and had him throw it out then. And throw the dice out, and the experiment was a complete failure, bombed entirely. Then they checked the dice for the throw after the one that they were trying to control, and he turned out to have beat it a billion with a B to one. And so that brings up a really interesting question. Is it are you dealing with what's going to happen in the future, or are you having an effect on what is going on right now? And At first, I believe that Ron came up with the idea that precognition existed, or helped to reinforce that for him. I'm thinking that maybe what actually happened was that the guy let it go, or the group around them that was doing it, they threw the dice out there, didn't get what they wanted, their bodies were kind of tightened up, and their emotions were tightened up, they were kind of saying no to themselves, they let it go, went on to the next number, and boom, it happened. So I think that's hard to know, but you could do that. You know, if you're a good remote viewer, like Russell Targ has a lot of information about how they worked in silver futures to predict what was going to happen, and so you possibly could, you know, find a string of numbers from the night before, and then I wouldn't say bet the farm on it, but you could be experimenting with, you know, after you've seen a 7, a 9, a 2, a 5, and you saw that, you know, remote view that the night before, you know what the next three numbers are going to be, you might go with it and see what, you know, what works for you. People are all different, but to say precisely, I'm not certain, but I think all of them can work and all of them have valid rationalizations.
Okay.
Hey Robert. You mentioned earlier that you'd been to some of the events where people are bending spoons using PK. Personally, I haven't been, but back in the day when I was a vice cop, I did go to a training, and one of the vice officers basically demonstrated spoon bending as a sleight of hand. Because it was one of these things that a lot of the, like, fortune tellers and stuff like that, quote-unquote fortune tellers, were doing to, like, establish credibility, and then they were, like, taking people for a financial ride. So can you explain what you saw and the method that they were using to bend the spoons? Because I've also seen stage magicians bend spoons, quote-unquote, psychically or with PK, and in fact, you know, it's an illusion. So can you just kind of, you know, elaborate on your experience?
Well, you're right. I think that anything you can do with your hands, you can probably figure out how to do, use a sleight of hand, because the hand is quicker than the eye, except when you've got a camera on it. And there's absolutely no doubt about that. It goes back to, as far as I can tell, spoon bending didn't exist very much before Uri Geller. And his story is that he was a kid, and he was walking in Tel Aviv, I believe it was, when he, I think it was a UFO thing, a light was over him, I think it was a UFO event of some kind, and he went into this lot that was empty originally because there was a gun in there, and he got hit with this light, or a light imbued him somehow. He goes home, and spoons start bending all over the place, and the silverware begins bending, and his mother got really upset with him. Is the way he tells the story, and really it was scolding and scolding, and finally figured out that in fact it was happening around him. And as we all know, you mentioned Uri Geller, you can't talk about him without talking about how he got caught cheating, because he was doing exactly what you're saying. He tried to do it on a television show, not the Johnny Carson show, but in Tel Aviv, and or something else, some kind of manipulation, a psychokinetic manipulation, and he got caught using magnets. Because all this stuff is very difficult to do on command all the time, 100% of the time. In television, you can't do that way. And even this guy Hume, whom they claim had floated out his window and out of the house and in another window, was, I believe, also busted. And most of these guys do get busted because they can't do it. So there is that aspect to it. You've got to be on the you got to be aware of it, that's out there, and that's going to happen. There are a lot of charlatans, and there could be all kinds of ways to get ripped off, especially if you begin believing in some of these people. However, my story with – I got two stories, actually, with three or four, with Jack Houck.
Well,
go ahead.
Good, because we have 11 minutes, and we want to fill that time. So if you've got a good story, we want to hear it.
Well, I found it interesting anyway, is that as I was making reservations to go down to Los Angeles to go to there's a place called the Living Temple, run by a fellow named Robin Jones down there, which he has all kinds of New Age and on the edge sort of things happening. And he had a group there, and Jack Houck was performing there. This engineer that I hadn't met him before, but as I was making the reservations, I was running back and forth between my kitchen and my computer. And so at one point, I laid a fork, and there's a space about 3 inches wide between a cabinet I have and my stove. I laid the fork down on there, came running back and went to Expedia or one of those places and made the reservation. I basically then went back to the kitchen, and nobody else was home at the time, and the fork was no longer on the, it was on the cabinet where I left it. In fact, it had bounced somehow off. It's a flat cabinet, and it turned around the other direction between the two. I mean, that was the first one. And then after going to a Jack Houck experience, I had this spoon. It's a he basically has spoons there that you can begin doing things with. And I personally never had the experience of bending a spoon with my consciousness that worked very well. But it was Friday the 13th, maybe a year ago, maybe a couple of years ago. I've got it sitting above a mirror on my house here above the fireplace. And Friday the 13th, it just bounces off the fireplace and onto the floor. So those are my my two Jack Houck things with the paranormal happening to me. But at the Jack Houck experience, again, what you do is you've got basically have a spoon in front of you that you're holding, and there are 15, maybe 35, 40 people in the room, and the first thing you do is visualize it becoming soft and rubbery, kind of like the spoon that you see in the movie The Matrix, where the kid just bends it and it falls over. And the first thing you do is that, and then you begin screaming, bend, bend, bend. And you got a room, and it's fun. You got a room, again, fun precedes psychokinetic energy, not the other way around. It precedes winning. And you got all these people that are in the room that are wanting it to happen. It's a little crazy. Everybody knows it's kind of crazy, and that's kind of the fun of it. And then eventually things begin happening, but you let it go, and hopefully things begin happening at that point. So I don't, I personally didn't have any experience with that, but on three different occasions, because I was at three different of those events, if you take one of the things that people try to do is take the cup of the spoon and try to bend it. And if you ever felt one of those, it's a dome, and you just—it's more difficult to do than the flat piece that you actually hold. It's just not a simple thing to do because it's so strong. Domes are very strong structures. And what we did do with a group of us getting together was we had maybe 10, 15 people, and people began looking at it also, yelling, bend, bend, bend. And I saw three different occasions people bend that piece of it. It wasn't sleight of hand. I took also, at one point, the guy gave me the spoon back, and I said, I'm going to myself, well, just how darn tough was this? And I started bending it back to try to bend it back to the normal shape it was, and that I couldn't do, and the guy grabs it out of my hand, because he didn't want me to destroy his spoon that he had just used his consciousness. We had just used our consciousness to get to happen.
Well, that's fascinating. So, you've also been, talking about faith healers in the context of PK and agreement. Do you have personal experience there in terms of, being present when there's something that, was unexplainable?
I haven't. I've got to admit that I haven't. I include it because I know it's there. There's no doubt in my mind about it because I have had all this all these experiences in these other realms and in other venues, but I know that a lot of your audience, when you're dealing with the magical, metaphysical, spiritual, and I began combining it with gambling. You've got what many people think is the highest, most sensitive stuff, combined with the most materialistic, and so they sort of move away from it a little bit. And people that understand it, as basically being a very sensitive, realm to go in. That's the only context that they have for it. I try to basically show that, in fact, it's part of everyday existence. And if you can do it at the most material level, working on those things, you can also do it on things that are also material, but that have other kinds of importances in your life besides maybe gambling, which is kind of frivolous. It's just, it's kind of like the spoon bending, which is in the same sense frivolous, but it's got to apply. The same things have to apply, and that's that. I mean, if you understand the principles, and again, the one I would get through, I'm going to reiterate for the 15th time, is emotion is the thing that we're all missing. Once you got the law of attraction going, what you want is people to agree on emotion. And that is going to do more for you and curing anybody that you want to cure than anything else you got going out there.
Yeah, the last time you were on the show, you know, we were talking about that sense of energy that you get, like, in a sports venue when there's 10,000 people all, like, focusing on, you know, a certain outcome or, you know, and they're investing all this, you know, emotional energy, and that, you know, it almost feels like it's something that you could reach out and touch. It's so real. Is that what you're talking about, only, you know, times 10,000?
Well, you know, I have ideas about that also, because I think there are ways to amplify. You know, we all know about Art Bell and George Norrie's work with that, where they've got audiences of million, and Art Bell was able to take a drought area and bring people about who, with a few million people, cause a huge rainstorm.
Didn't that scare him, actually?
It did, because I've had some experiences with that also, where it does become kind of scary, because there was the unknown that went into it. They possibly weren't specific enough in what they were trying to accomplish. Because it was just, well, let's just try this. And he didn't get that the consequences could have been negative, although you got to flip a coin. You know, if people had a drought and they're losing their farms or whatever was going on there, you know. But then the rain comes and they've got flash floods and people are underwater and they've got, the other side of some of that. You know, so that's – but what I've done is had ideas about how to intensify it, because the same thing is missing from what they're doing, and it's the same thing within a sports venue. What's missing, again, is ultimately the agreement. I mean, you've got what they're trying to do is focus on, if you got a pitcher, you want him to throw strikes, but you can agree about something else entirely. I mean, he could be throwing strikes, but you're talking politics, or you're doing a comedy routine that everybody's listening to. Wow. Go ahead.
No.
My point is if you got 2 million people there, you could arrange that so that you form groups that are specifically trying to work together. So in other words, you got 10 people in one place, and you got maybe 3,000 of those across the country. And you begin then each of you wanting the same thing simultaneously at the same time, but each of you forming your emotions around that group, and then figuring out how to maybe expand that so that you've maybe hooked up via some of the equipment that what is that company? That uses the Cisco. Cisco has this conferencing. It has this conferencing software, and you could potentially conference 10 different groups together. So you got, in each room you have, instead of just 10 people, 10 per groups, you got 100 people all at once. And they're doing the same thing simultaneously, listening to the same person simultaneously. And so my point was is that you could intensify that. You could also do that in a sports venue. You take 10 of your friends and you got the same seats together, and you begin doing your stuff, you can have an effect.
All right. Hey,
listen, we're out of time, Robert, so we need to – we want to thank you for being on.
Hi, Robert. Could you go ahead and tell us your website and your name of your book?
My name of the book is Art of Psychic Dice. The website is artofpsychicdice.com. It might be down right now. .com might be down because I'm changing the people that hold the name on it to another one. And so if it is, though, you can also go to artofpsychicdice.net.
Okay.
And .org, I think, also goes there.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Robert. Hey, listen, join Paranexus Universe on this coming Thursday. We have Lori Del Rio with the Psychic Perspective, and she's going to be talking about the use of psychics during investigations. Next Sunday, if you join us, it's going to be a live investigation at Jordan Springs again, and Doug Kelly and Sharon West is going to be there along with myself. So please join us next Sunday if you get a chance. And, Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I've had a wonderful time. Robert, we appreciate you coming by.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you both having me. I always enjoy chatting.
All right, if you'll hang loose a second after the show ends, I'll talk to you.
Thank you.
All right, man. And, everyone, we appreciate everybody showing up in the chat room. We appreciate everybody listening in. And remember, you can always get the podcast at... Boy, you're talking about freezing up, boy. Anyway, you can download the podcast. Everybody knows where that is. And we will see you Thursday night on Paranexus Universe with Lori Del Rio. Everybody have a good night. Have a good week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Good night, everyone.